Thank you for the root beer, Mr. Bradigan. It was very tasty. And with that, she led her son downstairs. When they got to the second floor landing, she dropped his hand and went the rest of the way ahead of him. Bobby thought they would discuss his new job further over supper, but they didn't. His mom seemed far away from him, her eyes distant. He had to ask her twice for a second slice of meatloaf, and when later that evening the telephone rang, she jumped up from the couch where they'd been watching TV to get it. She jumped for it the way Ricky Nelson did when it rang on the Ozzie and Harriet show. She listened, said something, then came back to the couch and sat down. "Who was it?" Bobby asked. "Wrong number," Liz said. In that year of his life, Bobby Garfield still waited for sleep with a child's welcoming confidence. On his back, heels spread to the corners of the bed, hands tucked into the cool under the pillows so his elbows stuck up. On the night after Ted spoke to him about the low men in their yellow coats, and don't forget their cars, he thought, their big cars with the fancy paint jobs, Bobby lay in this position with the sheet pushed down to his waist. Moonlight fell on his narrow child's chest, squared in four by the shadows of the window muntins. If he had thought about it, he hadn't. He would have expected Ted's low men to become more real once he was alone in the dark, with only the tick of his wind-up Big Ben and the murmur of the late TV news from the other room to keep him company. That was the way it had always been with him. It was easy to laugh at Frankenstein on shock theater, to go fake swoony and cry, "Oh, Frankie," when the monster showed up, especially if Sully John was there for a sleepover. But in the dark, after SJ had started to snore, or worse, if Bobby was alone, Dr. Frankenstein's creatures seemed a lot more, not real exactly, but possible. That sense of possibility did not gather around Ted's low men. If anything, the idea that people would communicate with each other via lost pet posters seemed even crazier in the dark. But not a dangerous crazy. Bobby didn't think Ted was really deeply crazy anyhow, just a bit too smart for his own good, especially since he had so few things with which to occupy his time. Ted was a little, well, cripes, a little what? Bobby couldn't express it. If the word eccentric had occurred to him, he would have seized it with pleasure and relief. But it seemed like he read my mind. What about that? Oh, he was wrong, that was all. Mistaken about what he thought he'd heard, or maybe Ted had read his mind, read it with that essentially uninteresting adult ESP, peeling guilt off his face like a wet decal off a piece of glass. God knew his mother could always do that, at least until today. But nothing. Ted was a nice guy who knew a lot about books, but he was no mind reader. No more than Sully John Sullivan was a magician or ever would be. "It's all misdirection," Bobby murmured. He slipped his hands out from under his pillow, crossed them at the wrists, wagged them. The shadow of a dove flew across the moonlight on his chest. Bobby smiled, closed his eyes, and went to sleep. The next morning he sat on the front porch and read several pieces aloud from the Harwich Sunday Journal. Ted perched on the porch glider, listening quietly and smoking Chesterfields behind him and to his left. The curtains flapped in and out of the open windows of the Garfield front room. Bobby imagined his mom sitting in the chair where the light was best, sewing basket beside her, listening and hemming skirts. Hemlines were going down again, she'd told him a week or two before. Take them up one year, pick out the stitches the following spring, and lower them again, all because of a bunch of poofers in New York and London said to. And why she bothered, she didn't know. Bobby had no idea if she really was there or not. The open windows and blowing curtains meant nothing by themselves, but he imagined it all the same. When he was a little older, it would occur to him that he had always imagined her there, outside doors, in that part of the bleachers where the shadows were too thick to see properly, in the dark at the top of the stairs. He had always imagined she was there. The sports pieces he read were interesting. Maury Wills was stealing up a storm. The feature articles less so, the opinion columns boring and long and incomprehensible, full of phrases like fiscal responsibility and economic indicators of a recessionary nature. Even so, Bobby didn't mind reading them. He was doing a job, after all, earning dough. And a lot of jobs were boring, at least, some of the time. You have to work for your Wheaties, his mother sometimes said after Mr. Biderman had kept her late. Bobby was proud, just to be able to get a phrase like economic indicators of a recessionary nature to come off his tongue. Besides, the other job, the hidden job, arose from Ted's crazy idea that some men were out to get him, and Bobby would have felt weird taking money just for doing that one. Would have felt like he was tricking Ted somehow, even though it had been Ted's idea in the first place. That was still part of his job, though, crazy or not, and he began doing it that Sunday afternoon. Bobby walked around the block while his mom was napping, looking for either low men in yellow coats or signs of them. He saw a number of interesting things. Over on Colony Street, a woman arguing with her husband about something. The two of them standing nose to nose like gorgeous George and Haystacks Calhoun before the start of a wrestling match. A little kid on Asher Avenue bashing caps with a smoke-blackened rock. Lip-block teenagers outside of Spicer's Variety Store on the corner of Commonwealth and Broad. A panel truck with the interesting slogan, Yummy for the Tummy, written on the side, but he saw no yellow coats or lost pet announcements on phone poles, not a single kite tail hung from a single telephone wire. He stopped in at Spicer's for a penny gumball and gleeped the bulletin board, which was dominated by photos of this year's Miss Rheingold candidates. He saw two cards offering cars for sale by owner, but neither was upside down. There was another one that said, Must sell my backyard pool, good shape, your kids will love it. And that one was crooked, but Bobby didn't guess crooked counted. On Asher Avenue, he saw a whale of a Buick parked at a hydrant, but it was bottle green, and Bobby didn't think it qualified as loud and vulgar, in spite of the portholes up the sides of the hood and the grill, which looked like the sneery mouth of a chrome catfish. On Monday, he continued looking for low men on his way to and from school. He saw nothing. But Carol Gerber, who was walking with him in SJ, saw him looking. His mother was right. Carol was really sharp. Are the commie agents after the plan? She asked. Huh? You keep staring everywhere, even behind you. For a moment, Bobby considered telling them what Ted had hired him to do, then decided it would be a bad idea. It might have been a good one if he believed there was really something to look for. Three pairs of eyes instead of one, Carol's sharp little peepers included. But he didn't. Carol and Sully John knew that he had a job reading Ted the paper every day, and that was all right. It was enough. If he told them about the low man, it would feel like making fun, somehow. A betrayal. Commie agents? Sully asked, whirling around. Yeah, I see him, I see him. He drew down his mouth and made the noise again. It was his favorite. Then he staggered, dropped his invisible Tommy gun, clutched his chest. They got me. I'm hit bad. Go on without me. Give my love to Rose. I'll give it to my aunt's fat Fanny, Carol said and elbowed him. I'm looking for guys from St. Gabe's, that's all, Bobby said. This was plausible. Boys from St. Gabriel, the steadfast upper and secondary, were always harassing the Harwich Elementary kids as the elementary kids walked to school, buzzing them on their bikes, shouting that the boys were sissies that the girls put out, which Bobby was pretty sure meant tongue-kissing and letting boys touch their titties. Nah, those dinkberries don't come along until later, Sully John said. Right now they're all still home putting on their crosses and combing their hair back like Bobby Rydell. Don't swear, Carol said and elbowed him again. Sully John looked wounded. Who swore? I didn't swear. Yes, you did. I did not, Carol. Did? No, sir, I did not. Yes, sir, did too. You said dinkberries. That's not a swear. Dinkberries are berries. S.J. looked at Bobby for help, but Bobby was looking up at Asher Avenue, where a Cadillac was cruising slowly by. It was big, and he supposed it was a little flashy, but wasn't any Cadillac. This one was painted a conservative light brown and didn't look low to him. Besides, the person at the wheel was a woman. "Yeah, show me a picture of a Dinkberry in the encyclopedia. Maybe I'll believe you." "I ought to poke you," Sully said amiably. "Show you who's boss. Me Tarzan, you Jane. Me Carol, you Jughead. Here." Carol thrust three books, Arithmetic, Adventures in Spelling, and The Little House on the Prairie, into S.J.'s hands. "Carry my books, 'cause you swore." Sully John looked more wounded than ever. "Why should I have to carry your stupid books, even if I did swear, which I didn't?" "It's penance," Carol said. "What the heck is penance?" "Making up for something you do wrong. If you swear or tell a lie, you have to do penance. One of the St. Gabe's boys told me. Willie, his name is." "You shouldn't hang around with them," Bobby said. "They can be mean." He knew this from personal experience. Just after Christmas vacation ended, three St. Gabe's boys had chased him down Broad Street, threatening to beat him up because he had looked at them wrong. They would have done it, too, Bobby thought, if the one in the lead hadn't slipped in the slush and gone to his knees. The others had tripped over him, allowing Bobby just time enough to nip in through the big front door of 149 and turn the lock. The St. Gabe's boys had hung around outside for a little while, then had gone away after promising Bobby that they would see him later. "They're not all hoods. Some of them are okay," Carol said. She looked at Sully John, who was carrying her books, and hid a smile with one hand. You could get S.J. to do anything if you talked fast and sounded sure of yourself. It would have been nicer to have Bobby carry her books, but it wouldn't have been any good unless he asked her. Someday he might. She was an optimist. In the meantime, it was nice to be walking here between them in the morning sunshine. She stole a glance at Bobby, who was looking down at a hopscotch grid drawn on the sidewalk. He was so cute. And he didn't even know it. Somehow that was the cutest thing of all. The last week of school passed, as it always did, with a maddening, half-crippled slowness. On those early June days, Bobby thought the smell of the paste in the library was almost strong enough to gag a maggot, and geography seemed to last 10,000 years. Who cared how much tin there was in Paraguay? At recess, Carol talked about how she was going to her Aunt Cora and Uncle Ray's farm in Pennsylvania for a week in July. S.J. went on and on about the week of camp he'd won and how he was going to shoot arrows at targets and go out in a canoe every day he was there. Bobby, in turn, told them about the great Maury Wills, who might set a record for base stealing that would never be broken in their lifetime. His mom was increasingly preoccupied, jumping each time the telephone rang and then running for it, staying up past the late news. And sometimes, Bobby suspected, until the Night Owl movie was over, and only picking at her meals. Sometimes she would have long, intense conversations on the phone with her back turned and her voice lowered, as if Bobby wanted to eavesdrop on her conversations anyway. Sometimes she'd go to the telephone, start to dial it, then drop it back in its cradle and return to the couch. On one of these occasions, Bobby asked her if she'd forgotten what number she wanted to call. "Seems like I've forgotten a lot of things," she muttered. And then, "Mind your beeswax, Bobby-o." He might have noticed more and worried even more than he did. She was getting thin and had picked up the cigarette habit again after almost stopping for 2 years, if he hadn't had lots of stuff to occupy his own mind and time. The best thing was the adult library card, which seemed like a better gift, a more inspired gift each time he used it. Bobby felt there were a billion science fiction novels alone in the adult section that he wanted to read. Take Isaac Asimov, for instance. Under the name of Paul French, Mr. Asimov wrote science fiction novels for kids about a space pilot named Lucky Star, and they were pretty good. Under his own name, he'd written other novels, even better ones. At least three of them were about robots. Bobby loved robots. Robbie the Robot in Forbidden Planet was one of the all-time great movie characters, in his opinion, totally ripshit, and Mr. Asimov's were almost as good. Bobby thought he would be spending a lot of time with them in the summer ahead. Sully called this great writer Isaac Asimov, but of course Sully was almost totally ignorant about books. Going to school, he looked for the men in the yellow coats, or signs of them. Going to the library after school, he did the same. Because school and library were in opposite directions, Bobby felt he was covering a pretty good part of Harwich. He never expected to actually see any low men, of course. After supper, in the long light of evening, he would read the paper to Ted, either on the porch or in Ted's kitchen. Ted had followed Liz Garfield's advice and gotten a fan, and Bobby's mom no longer seemed concerned that Bobby should read to Mr. Bradigan out on the porch. Some of this was her growing preoccupation with her own adult matters, Bobby felt, but perhaps she was also coming to trust Ted a little more. Not that trust was the same as liking. Not that it had come easily, either. One night, while they were on the couch watching Wyatt Earp, his mom turned to Bobby almost fiercely and said, "Does he ever touch you?" Bobby understood what she was asking, but not why she was so wound up. "Well, sure," he said. "He claps me on the back sometimes, and once when I was reading the paper to him and screwed up some really long words 3 times in a row, he gave me a Dutch rub, but he doesn't roughhouse or anything. I don't think he's strong enough for stuff like that. Why?" "Never mind," she said. "He's fine, I guess. Got his head in the clouds, no question about it, but he doesn't seem like a..." She trailed off, watching the smoke from her cool cigarette rise in the living room air. It went up from the coal in a pale gray ribbon and then disappeared, making Bobby think of the way the characters in Mr. Simak's Ring Around the Sun followed the spiraling top into other worlds. At last she turned to him again and said, "If he ever touches you in a way you don't like, you come and tell me right away. You hear?" "Sure, Mom." There was something in her look that made him remember once when he'd asked her how a woman knew she was going to have a baby. "She bleeds every month," his mom had said. "If there's no blood, she knows it's because the blood is going into a baby." Bobby had wanted to ask where this blood came out when there was no baby being made. He remembered a nosebleed his mom had had once, but no other instances of maternal bleeding. The look on her face, however, had made him drop the subject. She wore the same look now. Actually, there had been other touches. Ted might run one of his big hands across Bobby's crew cut, kind of patting the bristles. He would sometimes gently catch Bobby's nose between his knuckles and intone, "Sound it out," if Bobby mispronounced a word. If they spoke at the same moment, he would hook one of his little fingers around one of Bobby's little fingers and say, "Good luck, good will, good fortune, not ill." Soon Bobby was saying it with him, their little fingers locked, their voices as matter-of-fact as people saying, "Pass the peas," or "How you doing?" Only once did Bobby feel uncomfortable when Ted touched him. Bobby had just finished the last newspaper piece Ted wanted to hear, some columnist blabbing on about how there was nothing wrong with Cuba that good old American free enterprise couldn't fix. Dusk was beginning to streak the sky. Back on Colony Street, Mrs. O'Hara's dog Bowser barked on and on, "Roof, roof, roof," the sound lost and somehow dreamy, seeming more like something remembered than something happening at that moment. "Well," Bobby said, folding the paper and getting up, "I think I'll take a walk around the block and see what I see." He didn't want to come right out and say it, but he wanted Ted to know he was still looking for the low men in the yellow coats. Ted also got up and approached him. Bobby was saddened to see the fear on Ted's face. He didn't want Ted to believe in the low men too much, didn't want Ted to be too crazy. Be back before dark, Bobby. I'd never forgive myself if something happened to you. I'll be careful, and I'll be back years before dark. Ted dropped to one knee. He was too old to just hunker, Bobby guessed. And took hold of Bobby's shoulders. He drew Bobby forward until their brows were almost bumping. Bobby could smell cigarettes on Ted's breath and ointment on his skin. He rubbed his joints with Mustarol because they ached. These days they ached even in warm weather, he said. Being this close to Ted wasn't scary, but it was sort of awful. Just the same, you could see that even if Ted wasn't totally old now, he soon would be. He'd probably be sick, too. His eyes were watery. The corners of his mouth were trembling a little. It was too bad he had to be all alone up there on the third floor, Bobby thought. If he'd had a wife or something, he might never have gotten this bee in his bonnet about the low men. Of course, if he'd had a wife, Bobby might never have read Lord of the Flies. A selfish way to think, but he couldn't help it. No sign of them, Bobby. Bobby shook his head. And you feel nothing? Nothing here? He took his right hand from Bobby's left shoulder and tapped his own temple where two blue veins nested, pulsing slightly. Bobby shook his head. Or here? Ted pulled down the corner of his right eye. Bobby shook his head again. Or here? Ted touched his stomach. Bobby shook his head a third time. Okay, Ted said and smiled. He slipped his left hand up to the back of Bobby's neck. His right hand joined it. He looked solemnly into Bobby's eyes, and Bobby looked solemnly back. You'd tell me if you did, wouldn't you? You wouldn't try to. Oh, I don't know. To spare my feelings? No, Bobby said. He liked Ted's hands on the back of his neck and didn't like them at the same time. It was where a guy in a movie might put his hands just before he kissed a girl. No, I'd tell. That's my job. Ted nodded. He slowly unlaced his hands and let them drop. He got to his feet, using the table for support, and grimacing when one knee popped loudly. Yes, you'd tell me you're a good kid. Go on, take your walk, but stay on the sidewalk, Bobby, and be home before dark. You have to be careful these days. I'll be careful, he started down the stairs. And if you see them, I'll run. Yeah. In the fading light, Ted's face was grim, like hell was after you. So there had been touching, and perhaps his mother's fears had been justified in a way. Perhaps there had been too much touching and some of the wrong sort, not wrong in whatever way she thought maybe, but still wrong, still dangerous. On the Wednesday before school let out for the summer, Bobby saw a red strip of cloth hanging from somebody's TV antenna over on Colony Street. He couldn't tell for sure, but it looked remarkably like a kite tail. Bobby's feet stopped dead. At the same time, his heart accelerated until it was hammering the way it did when he raced Sully John home from school. It's a coincidence, even if it is a kite tail, he told himself. Just a lousy coincidence. You know that, don't you? Maybe he knew. He had almost come to believe it anyway when school let out for the summer on Friday. Bobby walked home by himself that day. Sully John had volunteered to stay and help put books away in the storeroom, and Carol was going over Tina Levels for Tina's birthday party. Just before crossing Asher Avenue and starting down Broad Street Hill, he saw a hopscotch grid drawn on the sidewalk in purple chalk. Oh, Christ, no, Bobby whispered. You gotta be kidding. He dropped to one knee like a cavalry scout in a Western movie, oblivious of the kids passing by him on their way home, some walking, some on bikes, a couple on roller skates, buck-toothed Francis Utterson on his rusty red scooter honking laughter at the sky as he paddled along. They were almost as oblivious of him. The big vake had just started and most were dazed by all the possibilities. Oh, no, I don't believe it. You gotta be kidding. He reached out toward the star and the crescent moon. They were drawn in yellow chalk, not purple. Almost touched them, then drew his hand back. A piece of red ribbon caught on a TV antenna didn't have to mean anything. When you added this, though, could it still be coincidence? Bobby didn't know. He was only 11, and there were a bazillion things he didn't know, but he was afraid. Afraid that... He got to his feet and looked around, half expecting to see a whole line of long, overbright cars coming down Asher Avenue, rolling slow the way cars did when they were following a hearse to the graveyard, with their headlights on in the middle of the day. Half expecting to see men in yellow coats standing beneath the marquee of the Asher Empire, or out in front of Suki's Tavern smoking camels and watching him. No cars. No men. Just kids heading home from school. The first ones from St. Gabe's, conspicuous in their green uniform pants and skirts, were visible among them. Bobby turned around and backtracked for 3 blocks up Asher Avenue, too worried about what he'd seen chalked in the sidewalk to concern himself about bad-tempered St. Gabe's boys. There was nothing on the avenue telephone poles but a few posters advertising bingo night at the St. Gabriel Parish Hall, and one on the corner of Asher and Tacoma, announcing a rock and roll show in Hartford starring Clyde McFadder and Duane Eddy, the man with the twangy guitar. By the time he got to Asher Avenue News, which was almost all the way back to school, Bobby was starting to hope he had overreacted. Still, he went in to look at their bulletin board, then all the way down Broad Street to Spicer's Variety, where he bought another gumball, and checked that bulletin board as well. Nothing suspicious on either one. In Spicer's, the card advertising the backyard pool was gone, but so what? The guy had probably sold it. Why else had he put the card up in the first place, for God's sake? Bobby left and stood on the corner, chewing his gumball and trying to make up his mind what to do next. Adulthood is accretive by nature, a thing which arrives in ragged stages and uneven overlaps. Bobby Garfield made the first adult decision of his life on the day he finished the 6th grade, concluding it would be wrong to tell Ted about the stuff he had seen, at least for the time being. His assumption that the low men didn't exist had been shaken, but Bobby wasn't ready to give it up, not on the evidence he had so far. Ted would be upset if Bobby told him what he'd seen, maybe upset enough to toss his stuff back into his suitcases, plus those carry-handle bags folded up behind his little fridge, and just take off. If there really were bad guys after him, flight would make sense, but Bobby didn't want to lose the only adult friend he'd ever had, if there weren't. So he decided to wait and see what, if anything, happened next. That night, Bobby Garfield experienced another aspect of adulthood. He lay awake until well after his Big Ben alarm clock said it was 2 in the morning, looking up at the ceiling and wondering if he had done the right thing. Four. Ted goes blank. Bobby goes to the beach. McQuown, the Winkle. The day after school ended, Carol Gerber's mom crammed her Ford estate wagon with kids and took them to Savin Rock, a seaside amusement park 20 miles from Harwich. Anita Gerber had done this 3 years running, which made it an ancient tradition to Bobby, S.J., Carol, Carol's little brother, and Carol's girlfriends Yvonne, Angie, and Tina. Neither Sully John nor Bobby would have gone anywhere with 3 girls on his own, but since they were together, it was okay. Besides, the lure of Savin Rock was too strong to resist. It would still be too cold to do much more than wade in the ocean, but they could goof on the beach and all the rides would be open. The Midway, too. The year before, Sully John had knocked down 3 pyramids of wooden milk bottles with just 3 baseballs, winning his mother a large pink teddy bear which still held pride of place on top of the Sullivan TV. Today, SJ wanted to win it a mate. For Bobby, just getting away from Harwich for a little while was an attraction. He had seen nothing suspicious since the star and the moon scribbled next to the hopscotch grid, but Ted gave him a bad scare while Bobby was reading him the Saturday newspaper, and hard on the heels of that came an ugly argument with his mother. The thing with Ted happened while Bobby was reading an opinion piece scoffing at the idea that Mickey Mantle would ever break Babe Ruth's home run record. He didn't have the stamina or the dedication, the columnist insisted. Above all, the character of this man is wrong, Bobby read. The so-called Mick is more interested in nightclubbing than... Ted had blanked out again. Bobby knew this, felt it somehow even before he looked up from the newspaper. Ted was staring emptily out his window toward Colony Street and the hoarse, monotonous barking of Mrs. O'Hara's dog. It was the second time he'd done it this morning, but the first lapse had lasted only a few seconds. Ted bent into the open refrigerator, eyes wide in the frosty light, not moving, then giving a jerk, a little shake, and reaching for the orange juice. This time he was totally gone. Wigsville, man, as Cookie might have said on 77 Sunset Strip. Bobby rattled the newspaper to see if he could wake him up that way. Nothing. Ted? Are you all right? With sudden dawning horror, Bobby realized something was wrong with the pupils of Ted's eyes. They were growing and shrinking in his face as Bobby watched. It was as if Ted were plunging rapidly in and out of some abysmally black place, and yet all he was doing was sitting there in the sunshine. Ted? A cigarette was burning in the ashtray, except it was now nothing but stubborn ash. Looking at it, Bobby realized Ted must have been out for almost the entire article on Mantle. And that thing his eyes were doing, the pupils swelling and contracting. He's having an epilepsy attack or something. God, don't these sometimes swallow their tongues when that happens? Ted's tongue looked to be where it belonged, but his eyes, Ted, wake up! Bobby was around to Ted's side of the table before he was even aware he was moving. He grabbed Ted by the shoulders and shook him. It was like shaking a piece of wood carved to look like a man. Under his cotton pullover shirt, Ted's shoulders were hard and scrawny and unyielding. Wake up! Wake up! They draw west now. Ted continued to look out the window with his strange, moving eyes. That's good. But they may be back. Bobby stood with his hands on Ted's shoulders, frightened and awestruck. Ted's pupils expanded and contracted like a heartbeat, you could see. Ted! Ted, what's wrong? I must be... very still. I must be a hare in the bush. They may pass by. There will be water if God wills it, and they may pass by. All things serve. Serve what? Almost whispering now. Serve what, Ted? All things. Serve the beam, Ted said, and suddenly his hands closed over Bobby's. They were very cold, those hands, and for a moment Bobby felt nightmarish, fainting terror. It was like being gripped by a corpse that could only move its hands and the pupils of its dead eyes. Then Ted was looking at him, and although his eyes were frightened, they were almost normal again, not dead at all. Bobby? Bobby pulled his hands free and put them around Ted's neck. He hugged him, and as he did, Bobby heard a bell tolling in his head. This was very brief, but very clear. He could even hear the pitch of the bell shift, the way the pitch of a train whistle did if the train was moving fast. It was as if something inside his head were passing at high speed. He heard a rattle of hooves on some hard surface. Wood? No, metal. He smelled dust, dry and thundery in his nose. At the same moment, the backs of his eyes began to itch. Ted's breath in his ear was as dry as the smell of that dust and somehow intimate. His hands were on Bobby's back, cupping his shoulder blades and holding him still. Not a word, not a thought, except baseball, yes, baseball, if you like. Bobby thought of Maury Wills getting his lead off first, a walking lead, measuring three steps, then four. Wills bent over at the waist, hands dangling, heels raised slightly off the dirt. He can go either way. It depends on what the pitcher does. And when the pitcher goes to the plate, Wills heads for second in an explosion of speed and dust and... gone. Everything was gone. No bell ringing in his head, no sound of hooves, no smell of dust. No itching behind his eyes, either. Had that itching really ever been there, or had he just made it up because Ted's eyes were scaring him? Bobby, Ted said, again directly into Bobby's ear. The movement of Ted's lips against his skin made him shiver. Then, good God, what am I doing? He pushed Bobby away, gently but firmly. His face looked dismayed and a little too pale. But his eyes were back to normal, his pupils holding steady. For the moment, that was all Bobby cared about. He felt strange, though, muzzy in the head, as if he'd just woken up from a heavy nap. At the same time, the world looked amazingly brilliant. Every line and shape perfectly defined. Shazam, Bobby said and laughed shakily. What just happened? Nothing to concern you. Ted reached for his cigarette and seemed surprised to see only a tiny smoldering scrap left in the groove where he had set it. He brushed it into the ashtray with his knuckle. I went off again, didn't I? Yeah, way off. I was scared. I thought you were having an epilepsy fit or something. Your eyes. It's not epilepsy, Ted said, and it's not dangerous. But if it happens again, it would be best if you didn't touch me. Why? Ted lit a fresh cigarette, just because, will you promise? Okay. What's the beam? Ted gazed at him sharply. I spoke of the beam. You said all things serve the beam? I think that was it. Perhaps sometime I'll tell you, but not today. Today you're going to the beach, aren't you? Bobby jumped, startled. He looked at Ted's clock and saw it was almost 9 o'clock. Yeah, he said. Maybe I ought to start getting ready. I could finish reading you the paper when I get back. Yes, good. A fine idea. I have some letters to write. No, you don't. You just want to get rid of me before I ask any other questions you don't want to answer. But if that was what Ted was doing, it was all right. As Liz Garfield so often said, Bobby had his own fish to fry. Still, as he reached the door to Ted's room, the thought of the red scrap of cloth hanging from the TV aerial and the crescent moon and the star next to the hopscotch grid made him turn reluctantly back. Ted, there's something. The low men. Yes, I know. Ted smiled. For now, don't trouble yourself about them, Bobby. For now, all is well. They aren't moving this way or even looking this way. They draw west, Bobby said. Ted looked at him through a scurf of rising cigarette smoke, his blue eyes steady. Yes, he said. And with luck, they'll stay west. Seattle would be fine with me. Have a good time at the seaside, Bobby.
But I saw...
Perhaps you saw only shadows. In any case, this isn't the time to talk. Just remember what I said. If I should go blank like that again... Just sit and wait for it to pass. If I should reach for you, stand back. If I should get up, tell me to sit down. In that state, I will do as you say. It's like being hypnotized. Why do you... No more questions about me, please. You're okay? Really okay? In the pink. Now go. Enjoy your day.
Bobby hurried downstairs, again struck by how sharp everything seemed to be, the brilliance of the light slanting through the window on the second floor landing. A ladybug crawling around the lip of an empty milk bottle outside the door of the Prosky's apartment. A sweet, high humming in his ears that was like the voice of the day. The first Saturday of summer vacation. Back in the apartment, Bobby grabbed his toy cars and trucks from various stashes under his bed and at the back of his closet. A couple of these, a Matchbox Ford and a blue metal dump truck Mr. Biderman had sent home with his mom a few days after Bobby's birthday, were pretty cool, but he had nothing to rival Sully's gasoline tanker or yellow Tonka bulldozer. The dozer was especially good to play with in the sand. Bobby was looking forward to at least an hour's serious road building, while the waves broke nearby and his skin pinkened in the bright coastal sunshine. It occurred to him that he hadn't gathered up his trucks like this since some time last winter, when he and SJ had spent a happy post-blizzard Saturday afternoon making a road system in the fresh snow down Commonwealth Park. He was old now, 11, almost too old for stuff like this. There was something sad about that idea. But he didn't have to be sad right now. Not if he didn't want to. His toy truck days might be fast approaching their end, but that end wouldn't be today. Nope, not today. His mother packed him a lunch for the trip, but she wouldn't give him any money when he asked. Not even a nickel for one of the private changing stalls which lined the ocean side of the Midway. And almost before Bobby realized it was happening, they were having what he most dreaded, an argument about money. 50 cents would be enough, Bobby said. He heard the baby whine in his voice, hated it, couldn't stop it. Just half a rock? Come on, Mom, what do you say? Be a sport. She lit a cool, striking the match so hard it made a snapping sound, and looked at him through the smoke with her eyes narrowed. You're earning your own money now, Bob. Most people pay 3 cents for the paper, and you get paid for reading it. A dollar a week? My God, when I was a girl? Mom, that money's for my bike, you know that. She had turned to the mirror, frowning and fussing at the shoulders of her blouse. Mr. Biderman had asked her to come in for a few hours, even though it was Saturday. Now she turned back, cigarette still clamped between her lips, and bent her frown on him. You're still asking me to buy you that bike, aren't you? Still. I told you I couldn't afford it, but you're still asking. No, I'm not. I'm not either. Bobby's eyes were wide with anger and hurt. Just a lousy half rock for the half a buck here, 2 bits there. It all adds up, you know. What you want is for me to buy you that bike by handing you the money for everything else. Then you don't have to give up any of the other things you want. That's not fair. He knew what she would say before she said it. He even had time to think that he had walked right into that one. Life's not fair, Bobby-o. Turning back to the mirror for one final pluck at the ghost of a slip strap hovering beneath the right shoulder of her blouse. A nickel for the changing room? Bobby asked. Couldn't you at least... Yes, probably. Oh, I imagine, she said, clipping off each word. She usually put rouge on her cheeks before going to work, but not all the color in her face this morning came out of a powder box, and Bobby, angry as he was, knew he'd better be careful. If he lost his temper the way she was capable of losing hers, he'd be here in the hot, empty apartment all day, forbidden to so much as step out into the hall. His mother snatched her purse off the table by the end of the couch, butted out her cigarette hard enough to split the filter, then turned and looked at him. If I said to you, gee, we can't eat this week because I saw a pair of shoes at Hunsicker's that I just had to have, what would you think? I'd think you were a liar, Bobby thought, and I'd say if you're so broke, Mom, what about the Sears catalog on the top shelf of your closet, the one with the dollar bills and the $5 bills, even a 10 or two, taped to the underwear pages in the middle? What about the blue pitcher in the kitchen dish cabinet, the one tucked all the way in the back corner behind the gravy boat with the crack in it, the blue pitcher where you put your spare quarters, where you've been putting them ever since my father died, and when the pitcher's full, you roll the quarters and take them to the bank and get bills, and the bills go into the catalog, don't they? The bills get taped to the underwear pages of the wish book. But he said none of this, only looked down at his sneakers with his eyes burning. "I have to make choices," she said. "And if you're old enough to work, sonny boy of mine, you'll have to make them too. Do you think I like telling you no?"
Not exactly, Bobby thought, looking at his sneakers and biting at his lip, which wanted to loosen up and start letting out a bunch of blubbery baby sounds. "Not exactly, but I don't think you really mind it either."
"If we were the Gottrocks, I'd give you $5 to spend at the beach. Hell, 10. You wouldn't have to borrow from your bike jar if you wanted to take your little girlfriend on the loop-de-loop." "She's not my girlfriend," Bobby screamed at his mother inside his head. "She is not my little girlfriend." "Or the Indian Railroad. But, of course, if we were the Gottrocks, you wouldn't need to save for a bike in the first place, would you?" Her voice rising, whatever had been troubling her over the last few months, threatening to come rushing out, foaming like soda pop and biting like acid. "I don't know if you ever noticed this, but your father didn't exactly leave us well off, and I'm doing the best I can. I feed you, I put clothes on your back, I paid for you to go to Sterling House this summer and play baseball while I push paper in that hot office. You got invited to go to the beach with the other kids. I'm very happy for you, but how you finance your day off is your business. If you want to ride the rides, take some of the money you've got in that jar and ride them. If you don't, just play on the beach or stay home. Makes no difference to me. I just want you to stop whining. I hate it when you whine. It's like..."
She stopped, sighed, opened her purse, took out her cigarettes.
"I hate it when you whine," she repeated.
"It's like your father." That was what she had stopped herself from saying.
"So what's the story, Morning Glory?" she asked. "Are you finished?"
Bobby stood silent, cheeks burning, eyes burning, looking down at his sneakers and focusing all his will on not blubbering. At this point, a single choked sob might be enough to get him grounded for the day. She was really mad, only looking for a reason to do it, and blubbering wasn't the only danger. He wanted to scream at her that he'd rather be like his father than like her, a skin-flinty old cheapskate like her, not good for even a lousy nickel. And so what if the late, not-so-great Randall Garfield hadn't left them well off? Why did she always make it sound like that was his fault? Who had married him?
"You sure, Bobby-O? No more smart-ass comebacks?"
The most dangerous sound of all had come into her voice, a kind of brittle brightness. It sounded like good humor if you didn't know her. Bobby looked at his sneakers and said nothing, kept all the blubbering and all the angry words locked in his throat and said nothing. Silence spun out between them. He could smell her cigarette and all of last night's cigarettes behind this one, and those smoked on all the other nights when she didn't so much look at the TV as through it, waiting for the phone to ring. "All right, I guess we've got ourselves straight," she said, after giving him 15 seconds or so to open his mouth and stick his big fat foot in it. "Have a nice day, Bobby." She went out without kissing him. Bobby went to the open window. Tears were running down his face now, but he hardly noticed them. He drew aside the curtain and watched her head toward Commonwealth, high heels tapping. He took a couple of big watery breaths and then went into the kitchen. He looked across at the cupboard where the blue pitcher hid behind the gravy boat. He could take some money out of it. She didn't keep any exact count of how much was in there, and she'd never miss 3 or 4 quarters, but he wouldn't. Spending it would be joyless. He wasn't sure how he knew that, but he did. Had known it even at 9, when he first discovered the pitcher of change hidden there. So with feelings of regret rather than righteousness, he went into his bedroom and looked at the bike fund jar instead. It occurred to him that she was right. He could take a little of his saved dough to spend at Seven Rock. It might take him an extra month
to accumulate the price of the Schwinn, but at least spending this money would feel all right. And there was something else as well. If he refused to take any money out of the jar to do anything but hoard it and save it, he'd be like her. That decided the matter. Bobby fished 5 dimes out of the bike fund, put them in his pocket, put a Kleenex on top of them to keep them from bouncing out if he ran somewhere, then finished collecting his stuff for the beach. Soon, he was whistling, and Ted came downstairs to see what he was up to. "Are you off, Captain Garfield?" Bobby nodded. "Savin Rock's a pretty cool place. Rides and stuff, you know?"
"Indeed I do. Have a good time, Bobby, and don't fall out of anything."
Bobby started for the door, then looked back at Ted, who was standing on the bottom step of the stairs in his slippers. "Why don't you come out and sit on the porch?" Bobby asked. "It's going to be hot in the house, I bet."
Ted smiled, perhaps, but I think I'll stay in.
"You okay?"
"I'm fine, Bobby. I'm fine."
As he crossed to the Gerber's side of Broad Street, Bobby realized he felt sorry for Ted hiding up in his hot room for no reason. And it had to be for no reason, didn't it? Sure it did. Even if there were low men out there cruising around someplace in the West, he thought, they draw west. What could they want of an old retired guy like Ted Brodigan? At first, the quarrel with his mother weighed him down a little. Mrs. Gerber's pudgy, pretty friend, Rion de Hewson, accused him of being in a brown study,
whatever that was,
then began tickling him up the sides and in the armpits until Bobby laughed in self-defense. But after they'd been on the beach a little while, he began to feel better, more himself. Although it was still early in the season, Savin Rock was full speed ahead, the merry-go-round turning, the wild mouse roaring, the little kids screaming, tinny rock and roll pouring from the speakers outside the funhouse, the barkers hollering from their booths. Sully John didn't get the teddy bear he wanted, knocking over only 2 of the last 3 milk bottles. Rionda claimed some of them had special weights in the bottom to keep them from going over unless you whacked them just right. But the guy in the baseball toss booth awarded him a pretty neat prize anyway, a goofy-looking anteater covered with yellow plush. SJ impulsively gave it to Carol's mom. Anita laughed and hugged him and told him he was the best kid in the world. If he was 15 years older, she'd commit bigamy and marry him. Sully John blushed until he was purple. Bobby tried the ring toss and missed with all 3 throws. At the shooting gallery, he had better luck, breaking 2 plates and winning a small stuffed bear. He gave it to Ian the Snot, who had actually been good for a change, hadn't thrown any tantrums, wet his pants, or tried to sock either Sully or Bobby in the nuts. Ian hugged the bear and looked at Bobby as if Bobby were God.
"It's great, and he loves it," Anita said, "but don't you want to take it home to your mother?"
"Nah, she's not much on stuff like that. I like to win her a bottle of perfume, though."
He and Sully John dared each other to go on a wild mouse, and finally went together, howling deliriously as their car plunged into each dip, simultaneously sure they were going to live forever and die immediately. They went on the Tilt-A-Whirl and the Crazy Cups. Down to his last 15 cents, Bobby found himself on the Ferris wheel with Carol. Their car stopped at the top, rocking slightly, making him feel funny in his stomach. To his left, the Atlantic stepped shoreward in a series of white-topped waves. The beach was just as white, the ocean an impossible shade of deep blue. Sunlight ran across it like silk. Below them was the Midway. Rising up from the speakers came the sound of Freddie Cannon. "She comes from Tallahassee. She's got a hi-fi chassis."
"Everything down there looks so little," Carol said. Her voice was also little. Uncharacteristically so.
"Don't be scared. We're safe as can be. The Ferris wheel would be a kiddie ride if it didn't go so high." Carol was, in many ways, the oldest of the 3 of them. Tough and sure of herself as on the day she'd made SJ carry her books for swearing, but now her face had almost become a baby's face again. Round, a little bit pale, dominated by a pair of alarmed blue eyes. Without thinking, Bobby leaned over, put his mouth on hers, and kissed her. When he drew back, her eyes were wider than ever. "Safe as can be," he said, and grinned. "Do it again." It was her first real kiss. She had gotten it at Savin Rock on the first Saturday of summer vacation, and she hadn't been paying attention. That was what she was thinking. That was why she wanted him to do it again.
"I better not," Bobby said. "Although up here, who was there to see and call him a sissy?"
"I dare you, and don't say dares go first."
"Will you tell?"
"No, swear to God. Go on, hurry up, before we go down."
So he kissed her again.
Her lips were smooth and closed, hot with the sun. Then the wheel began to move and he stopped. For just a moment, Carol laid her head against his chest. "Thank you, Bobby," she said. "That was nice as could be."
"I thought so, too." They drew apart from each other a little, and when their car stopped and a tattooed attendant swung the safety bar up, Bobby got out and ran without looking back at her to where SJ was standing. Yet he knew already that kissing Carol at the top of the Ferris wheel was going to be the best part of the day. It was his first real kiss, too, and Bobby never forgot the feel of her lips pressing on his, dry and smooth and warmed by the sun. It was the kiss by which all the others of his life would be judged and found wanting. Around 3 o'clock, Mrs. Gerber told them to start gathering their things. It was time to go home. Carol gave a token, "Oh, Mom," and then started picking stuff up. Her girlfriends helped. Even Ian helped a little, refusing even as he fetched and carried to let go of the sand-matted bear. Bobby had half expected Carol to tag after him for the rest of the day, and he'd been sure she'd tell her girlfriends about kissing on the Ferris wheel. He would know she had when he saw them in a little knot, giggling with their hands over their mouths, looking at him with their merry, knowing eyes. But she had done neither. Several times he'd caught her looking at him, though, and several times he'd caught himself sneaking glances at her. He kept remembering her eyes up there, how big and worried they had been. And he had kissed her, just like that. Bingo. Bobby and Sully toted most of the beach bags. "Good mules! Giddy up!" Rhonda cried, laughing as they mounted the steps between the beach and the boardwalk. She was lobster red under the cold cream she had smeared over her face and shoulders, and she moaned to Anita Gerber that she wouldn't sleep a wink that night, that if the sunburn didn't keep her awake, the midway food would. "Well, you didn't have to eat 4 wieners and 2 doughboys, Mrs. Gerber said, sounding more irritated than Bobby had ever heard her. She was tired, he reckoned. He felt a little dazed by the sun himself, his back prickled with sunburn, and he had sand in his socks. The beach bags with which he was festooned swung and bounced against each other. "But amusement park food's so good," Rhonda protested in a sad voice. Bobby laughed. He couldn't help it. They walked slowly along the midway toward the dirt parking lot, paying no attention to the rides now. The barkers looked at them, then looked past them for fresh blood. Folks loaded down and trudging back to the parking lot were, by and large, lost causes. At the very end of the midway, on the left, was a skinny man wearing baggy blue Bermuda shorts, a strap-style undershirt, and a bowler hat. The bowler was old and faded, but cocked at a rakish angle. Also, there was a plastic sunflower stuck in the brim. He was a funny guy, and the girls finally got their chance to put their hands over their mouths and giggle. He looked at them with the air
of a man who has been giggled at by experts and smiled back. This made Carol and her friends giggle harder. The man in the bowler hat, still smiling, spread his hands above the